Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And on our show today, we're going to be talking with psychiatrist Dr. Terry Coopers about the mental health crisis in America's prisons and some recent work and books that he's written on this topic, including his thoughts about the solitary confinement of Private Manning that was featured on CNN and all over the news.
Well, I'm glad that you had a chance to sit down with him, Adam. I'm looking forward to hearing that conversation. But first, we have some research that matters. We have research about heart attacks and fitness versus weight.
About some research on eczema and its relationship also with fitness, or in this case, obesity.
About eating fish being linked to stronger bones.
And then if anyone out there, a male or a parent of a male, a father, when should you maybe just quit getting those PSA tests or maybe never even start? But let's first start in, Christy, with this research about fitness and cardiovascular. Does it really matter if you're overweight if you're fit?
Yeah, this is a study that, I mean, the bottom line from this is the study found that fitness, more than your body weight, is a more important predictor of whether people who have heart disease or clogged blood vessels in their heart will die in the near term.
Yeah, this was in the study in the journal, American Heart Journal, looking at 855 men and women who were enrolled in a cardiac rehab program. And the patients walked on treadmills and saw how well they could walk and their ability to really be fit, and then really looked at their body mass index to see their overall follow-up, how that fitness and the body mass index related to overall cardiac health and mortality.
Yeah, they looked at, I mean, the risk of death. And so what they found were the people who did the best were the people who were of normal weight and fit. And the next strongest group were the people who were obese but fit. So fitness was more important than the weight.
Right. They were about twice as likely to die in follow-up as the people who were fit but normal weight. But, you know, it got a lot worse, so that if you were overweight fit, you really had a significantly higher risk of passing away, seven times higher. And even those that were not overweight but still not fit, they didn't do too good either.
Well, really, the take-home message here is that fitness and exercise is very, very important to keep your heart strong. And weight is important, too. But really, the focus on exercise and fitness is a little bit more important.
Yep. So if you're walking up that hill, whether you're overweight or normal weight, if you can walk up that hill without panning, that's a good sign.
It is.
Okay. What's our very next research about being overweight and eczema? Two common conditions, and some research suggests, at least among young children, they may be linked.
Yeah. So this is a study about children, and we know obesity in children is a major problem, as is eczema being, or something called atopic dermatitis, where kids get dry, itchy, inflamed skin. And this was a study looking at 2 and 5-year-olds to see any association between obesity and eczema.
Yeah, 400 children with this condition and about 800 who didn't have it. And looking in medical records published in the Journal of Allergy and Clinical Immunology, and really found that 5 out of 100 children who didn't have obesity had the skin disease. But if they had the obesity, it was almost twice as high. 9 out of every 100 had this condition, which suggests not necessarily that the obesity causes the eczema, but it may be that there are certain factors associated with weight gain that predispose some children to having this disease.
Well, and I think it's another reason for us to pay attention to maintaining and supporting a healthy weight in our children, and to us as physicians to say, oh, maybe we need to realize this for our patients, that they're more likely to have eczema, and maybe try to get a handle on it sooner.
Yeah, because, you know, one thing is that when people do become overweight and they develop more adipose or fat tissue, this does cause inflammation in the fat tissue, and that could actually have some relationship here. So maybe we also have to focus on treating the eczema, but also to losing some weight simultaneously. It certainly wouldn't hurt.
Absolutely not.
What's our very next research that matters, Christy?
This is about having a diet higher in fish being linked to strong bones. So this was a study looking at over 600 seniors who lived in Framingham, Massachusetts, so part of that big Framingham study, to survey them in the 80s and 90s on their eating habits and then follow them out over time.
Yeah, so, you know, the question is that if you eat more fish, can this protect against losing bone mass over time, which none of us really want to lose bone mass and become osteoporotic and have compression fractures of the spine. And these women in this study who ate three or more weekly servings of fish, like salmon, had smaller bone loss over 5 years compared to women who didn't eat as much fish.
And these were the dark fish, so salmon, mackerel, and you really had to have the omega-3 fatty acids in that fish. But, I mean, to me, Adam, the take-home point, I mean, we can't say this is causal, that if you eat more fish, this definitely will be the case for you. But it's another reason, to me, to recommend to folks to eat 2 to 3 servings of fish a week.
Yeah, this was published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. And the men who also ate the 3 times per week also had less bone loss than the men who did not. So I agree with you, Christy. The guidelines from the American Heart Association recommend 2 servings of fish a week. Here, 3 servings.
2 to 3.
Sounds good. What's our very last research that matters?
Okay. This is about prostate cancer tests, screening tests. A study looking at over 15,000 men to see how many people got PSA or blood screening for prostate cancer based on their age.
Yeah, and we'll start off by saying that Christy and I both realize prostate cancer, serious health problem among men, you know, outside of lung cancer, one of the top killers, more people diagnosed. But the problem is the PSA test is a little bit problematic. And as you get older, even if it were a good test, which Christy and I don't necessarily think it is, we wouldn't recommend it. So this study looked at what percentage of men at different ages, including those in their 80s, were getting a PSA test.
Well, and the issue here, Adam, is that people in your 80s, you might have prostate cancer, but you're very unlikely to die from it at that point. And your life expectancy, you know, thinking about things that we do to you versus for you. And so most people would not recommend people in their 80s be getting these sorts of tests. But in this study, it shows a lot of people are.
Yeah, the Journal of Clinical Oncology, the researchers looked at the men, and these are 2 different surveys in 2000 and 2005, and that about 1 in 4 men in their early 50s had been screened. And this went up to almost 1 out of 2 men in their early 70s. Which isn't too surprising, given when the study was done. But what was really surprising, I think, for me, maybe for you, Christy, is that 1 in 4 men age 85 and older said they had been screened in the past year, meaning that they were still getting screened way past the age when most of us could even conceive that prostate cancer, even if diagnosed, would be impactful on them.
Yeah, and you wonder if folks are having conversations with their doctor about would they really want to know this if you know, if it wouldn't necessarily impact their life.
Yeah, we should just be clear that the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, which is the national panel, recommended just recently in 2008 that the benefits of screening in men younger than 75 are uncertain and that the harm probably outweighs any benefit for men age 75 and older. So I think I stick by that. Probably you do too.
Yeah, I think if you're over 50, talk with your doctor about the pros and cons of screening. But if you're over 80 or 75 even, you probably do not need this screening. So we've had a chance to talk about prostate screening, about fish linked to stronger bones.
Two to three helpings a day, about eczema, and maybe if your child is overweight, that also losing weight at the same time.
And about fitness being very, very important to keeping your heart strong.
Yeah, well, that'll conclude Research That Matters. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, we'll hear a recent interview I just conducted with Dr. Terry Coopers about the mental health crisis in America's prisons. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we'll be talking with Dr. Terry Coopers about the mental health crisis in America's prisons. We came across Dr. Coopers in a recent poignant piece for CNN that he wrote about the solitary confinement of the WikiLeaks accuser, Army Private Bradley Manning. But we were more impressed with Dr. Coopers about the body of research and knowledge that he has written about for over a decade about mental health in our prisons. Dr. Coopers is a forensic psychiatrist and professor at the Wright Institute, a graduate school of psychology in Berkeley, California. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Coopers.
Good to be with you.
Dr. Coopers, you know, we often want to start off understanding a little bit about our guest and their own background. You have taken on what I would consider one of the most challenging issues of our time, and you've been doing this for a long time yourself. How did you get interested in this issue of prisoner and mental health?
Well, I actually have been doing this work since the 1970s. And what happened when I was finishing my psychiatry training in Los Angeles at UCLA is that the ACLU was suing the Los Angeles County Jail because of harsh conditions. It was massively crowded, and there were a lot of people with mental illness in jail who were not getting treatment. So they asked me to be their expert, which I did. And in doing that, I studied the problem. I went in and took a look at their situation, and I read what was known about jail and prison conditions, and I started testifying. And what I found was that there was an incredible proportion of the people with serious mental illness were actually locked up in jail or prison. And I started advocating for them to have some decent treatment.
Well, I can only imagine that this was not an over-populated group of psychiatrists and physicians around the country who just swelled to join you in this. Were there many people, and are there many people like yourself that are really advocating for this discipline?
Well, I think increasingly there are. I'm being asked by the American Psychiatric Association repeatedly to give talks about this. I was just invited to the residency program at the University of Maryland to give a talk about this problem.
Well, I know we're really quite appreciative, but let's just dive in then. And let me just ask you, one of the things I read in one of your articles, which I found provocative, entitled How to Create Madness in Prison, is you just cite a statistic, which is that there are more people suffering from serious mental illness in jails and prisons than there are in psychiatric hospitals. It's rare when I read something, I say, wow, that was a wow statement.
Well, but it's absolutely true. And what we had in the 1950s, when people with serious mental illness were in the state hospitals, there were 550,000 people with serious mental illness in the state hospitals. That number today is down around 50,000. That is, we've deinstitutionalized and removed them from the hospitals. Meanwhile, the prison population has multiplied, and there's now 2.5 million people in jail and prison, and probably over 50% of them suffer from a serious mental illness. So just doing the math, you find out that, you know, the major segment of people with mental illness are incarcerated.
Well, let me ask a question. If you think about prison, and I think most of us, if we've not been in prison, and I have not, would imagine that it is scary beyond belief and that it could produce mental illness even if you didn't have it going in. So is there a question here of cause and effect in terms of going to prison with mental illness, or once you get in prison, you develop mental illness?
Well, the answer is both and a combination, because most people enter prison in their late teens for the first time. And that's also when the major mental illnesses, schizophrenia and bipolar disorder, first become apparent. First breakdown happens late teens, early 20s. So it's all of the above. That is, there are people who go to prison and weren't mentally ill before they got there and become mentally ill in prison because of all the stresses in prison. There are people who were already mentally ill, and often that plays a part in their crime. And there's all kinds of combinations.
Well, is there a certain bias towards mental health in prison? I think, you know, there. Sometimes I see comments from friends, well, prisoners get better medical care than they do. Tell us a little bit about the care, the mental health care that's available for this incredible explosion of mental health illness in prisons.
Well, I'd be happy to. That's often the point of the lawsuits that I'm involved in as an expert witness. I go to assess the quality of mental health care. It's a myth, and what I mean is a falsehood, that people in prison with mental illness get better care than outside. What's true is that in the community, public mental health is deteriorating because of defunding of the public sector. But it's also deteriorating in prison, and only the most severely disturbed and problematic prisoners actually get help. If you watch the prison budget each year, you know, there's always the schools are being cut, health is being cut, and corrections in California, at least this is true, stays the same. But in fact, if you look inside the prison budget and you look at the mental health item, what you see is cuts that are actually worse than what's going on in the community. So the mental health services themselves are being cut while the cost for corrections is going up with new buildings and officers' salaries and that kind of thing.
So if we're thinking about the mental health conditions in the prison, you mentioned schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, but one thing that seemed obvious once you mentioned it and in one of your articles, but would seem like an overwhelming issue to deal with, is post-traumatic stress disorder. Can you discuss that briefly so our listeners would understand and help even myself understand how that plays out in all of its various manifestations in the prison population?
Yes. Well, post-traumatic stress disorder is very prevalent in prison and in jail. And studies have shown that something like 60 to 80% of prisoners have had past serious trauma, both physical and sexual abuse, and witnessing trauma and violence and that kind of thing. That doesn't mean they have post-traumatic stress disorder. A significant proportion of those people do. In prison, because of such a shortage of mental health care, the serious diagnoses like schizophrenia, and I say serious in quotes, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, major depressive disorder, that's what gets the attention, and usually all that's available is medication with very little therapy going on. So a condition like PTSD is considered relatively minor compared to those conditions, so there's very little treatment. And what we need to do to treat people with PTSD is talking therapy of some kind, group and individual therapy, psychiatric rehabilitation. That is generally not available in prison. And then on top of that, the prison conditions, and I'm talking about massive crowding, I'm talking about fights, prison rape, that kind of thing, and then spending time in segregation, solitary confinement, all of these things make post-traumatic stress disorder much worse. So there's a multiplicity of factors that make the condition severe and unremitting.
We're talking with Dr. Terry Coopers of the Wright Institute, a forensic psychologist and professor in Berkeley, California, about the medical ethics of and mental health within the prison population. Before we break, Dr. Coopers, I know we want to get into this issue of, you mentioned both overcrowding and solitary confinement. Can you just briefly, before the break, mention the significant mental health issues, concerns about both of those conditions in the prison population?
Yes, and they're related problems. We had a massive crowding problem in the prisons in the 70s and 80s. The prison population multiplied 10 times over between 1970 and the present. And as the crowding increased, we knew from social science research that violence rates go sky high with crowding, and so does mental breakdown. So in the 80s, the prisons were out of control. There were riots all over the country. There was violence in the prisons, and it's a huge problem. They made a mistake at that point. What happened was that the crowding was going on a lot because of the war on drugs. rehabilitation was being cut because of a fear of coddling the prisoners and that kind of thing. So they started building isolation units. They're called super maximum security prisons, where prisoners would spend 24 hours a day in their cell all by themselves. This, again, added harm to the already harmful situation, and prisoners in solitary confinement were actually prone to psychotic episodes and suicide. So that's the way it has gone, and I think it was a bad mistake historically to keep the crowding going, and the crowding still multiplies today, and to cut the rehab programs. And now we just have a huge number of people with serious mental illness that's getting worse because of the overly stressful conditions.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but I know we want to pick up on this topic and explore both its implications, but also the ethics behind it as a physician. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. Kerry Coopers, about mental health care in America's prisons. We'll be right back with Your Health.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with forensic psychologist Dr. Kerry Coopers about mental health care in America's prisons. Dr. Coopers is the author of a best-selling book called Prison Madness, and some of the discussion that we're having really deals with what might appear to lots of people as madness. But Dr. Coopers, when we talk about solitary confinement, which is where we left off, you in your article for CNN, you talk about Private Bradley Manning and show data about solitary confinement that I guess over half of all suicides that are occurring seem to occur in prisoners who are in solitary confinement. Tell us a little bit more about the effects of solitary confinement from a mental health perspective.
Yes, in terms of Bradley Manning, what we're seeing is that extreme situations where people are accused of being a security threat to the United States are treated in a way that the court has already found unconstitutional. And by that I mean severe solitary confinement with no activities, no visiting, no lawyer, that kind of thing. And he has subsequently been allowed to see his lawyer. But what's happening is that the federal government is using people who are a security threat or immigrants, terrorists, and using it as a way to break the Constitution. And that's very worrisome because constitutional law is one of the ways to protect people from horrible conditions. There's a stunning statistic in corrections, and that is solitary confinement really only involves something like 2 to 8% of the entire prison population. And this is across all the states and the federal system. But 50% of the completed suicides in prison today are occurring in solitary confinement, which is an amazing disproportion and shows that solitary confinement, among other things, causes despair and suicide. And that's what we're seeing an epidemic of, both in the prisons and then in the military brigs and where we're capturing enemy combatants and that kind of thing.
Well, the one argument that I heard publicly was that, well, a prisoner voices some sort of suicidal thought, so therefore that somehow justifies is putting them in solitary confinement. As a psychiatrist, can you discuss how you respond to that public statement?
The statement was it security?
Yes, that the prisoner voiced being suicidal, so therefore they're put in solitary confinement for their own protection.
Right. That makes no sense at all, and at some point I heard that Manning had been given involuntary antidepressant medications. I haven't been able to verify that. It's absurd because the conditions of solitary confinement actually cause despair and suicide, and therefore to put someone there for their own protection is just totally irrational.
So what is the standard approach to someone who did voice suicidal thoughts? What is the established standard of care in psychiatry?
Well, there's only one thing that we've ever found in hundreds of years of psychiatry that works, and that is to talk to the person. We simply need to talk to the person. We need to keep them safe, put them in a situation where they won't harm themselves while we have a chance to talk with them, and then try to get at to the basis for their despair. That's the only way to treat suicidal inclination. Medications are peripheral. First of all, they take a long time, the antidepressants, to start working. And second of all, someone who's intent on suicide is going to kill themselves even with medication. So the only thing we have to do is talk. And that's the one thing that doesn't happen in prison. Typically, people who are known to be suicidal because they tell a guard that they might want to end their life or they try to kill themselves, they're put in an observation cell, which is merely a solitary confinement cell where their clothes are taken away, they're allowed no possessions, and they sit and vegetate 24 hours a day. And mental health staff come by and see them very quickly and ask them if they're still suicidal. No one spends any significant time talking with them, and therefore they leave that isolation cell, in many cases, to go back to a regular solitary confinement cell, and that's where they kill themselves.
So from a medical perspective, because I don't want to get into a discussion of, you know, national security, that's not, as a physician, even though I might have opinions about it, from a medical perspective, it seems as if in your research that solitary confinement is a lose-lose. It doesn't do what, from a medical perspective, there's no gain to be had here, and it seems to break people down and make them even more anxious and more paranoid. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so I guess one of my questions really is, if that's an established fact, how do physicians, can they justify participating in this? I know the American Medical Association, I would assume the American Psychiatric Association, would look at physicians participating as they have, for instance, in the death penalty. How do they look at physicians participating in the, I don't want to say collusion, but in participation in solitary confinement in prisons?
Well, it's a very good question, and the answer is that the medical organizations, the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association, have taken a stand that physicians cannot participate, and this came with the question of enhanced interrogation, which really translates as torture. And there were medical personnel and psychiatrists who would, for instance, examine a person who was being interrogated and say that it's okay to go on. And we have suspicions that they might have given the interrogators some clues as to how best to break them down. The American Psychological Association at first took a stand that that was okay as long as the psychologist's mission was to reduce the damaging effects of the torture. The AMA and the APA both took the position that a physician, just like with the death penalty, is not to cooperate and not to provide medical care in that setting because the Hippocratic Oath says first do no harm. But on the issue of solitary confinement, it's more complicated. I am arguing, and I think there is overwhelming evidence for this, that it causes harm. There's a situation where we have a shortage of mental health staff. We have a lot of people locked up in solitary confinement cells in a segregation unit or a supermax prison. And the psychiatrist goes around and makes rounds talking to people at their cell front. That is, you've got all these cell doors along a hall. Psychiatrist walks up to a door and says, how are you doing? Are you hearing voices? Are you still feeling suicidal? How's the medication I gave you? There's no confidentiality. The person is disinclined to say anything of substance to the psychiatrist because they don't want the prisoners in the neighboring cells or the officers on the hallway to hear. And so they tend to say nothing, and therefore the psychiatrist doesn't get any information.
Well, you know,
it's an unethical practice. And in my view, that psychiatrist should refuse to do that and to say to the prison authorities, look, you either take this prisoner out of his cell and put him in a private confidential room for me to interview him, or I will not prescribe medications for him. They don't do that, and I believe it's an ethical breach, and just one example of the kind of ethical breaches that happen regularly in prison.
Yeah, you know, you compare, I guess, the current prison conditions with those of the quote-unquote snake pit mental asylum of the 1940s, and I think what you just described is one way that that could be the case. Very difficult, very disturbing. But I don't want to end today without knowing a little bit about your thoughts about where do we go from here. Clearly, treatment other models, other places, locations. Give us some sense, Dr. Coopers, what can we do to make a difference here?
Well, as I've said, there's a historical wrong turn that happened in the 80s, and that is we massively overcrowded the prisons, a lot of low-level drug offenses, that kind of thing, and we cut back on rehabilitation. That was a mistake. And then to further the mistake, what the authorities did in the legislatures is they built these supermax prisons, which institutionalized isolation. That is an error. That's a huge error that's causing much pain and suffering. The first thing that needs to happen is that the population needs to be reduced. Everyone who can be given an alternative to incarceration should be, and for instance, behavioral health courts are starting to do that at the front end. Other countries don't. The United States is incarcerating in prison a larger percentage of the overall population than any other developed country in the world. We just throw more people into prison, and I think it goes along with our lack of commitment to social welfare safety net programs, to public mental health, public health. And then what we're doing is disappearing the people who are suffering, the disadvantaged people who are ill, who aren't getting care, and we lock them up in prison where they're forgotten about. In other countries, for instance, in the Scandinavian countries, no one but the most serious offender goes to prison. Therefore, instead of having prisons that house thousands of prisoners, they have a few hundred prisoners. And they don't have guards. They don't have people who specialize in being security forces. Rather, they have people who get a master's degree that involves prison security, education, and mental health care. It's a three-way master's program, and that's who staffs the prisons.
Wow.
Their job is to work on the rehabilitation of those prisoners, and they're very successful.
Wow.
There are other versions like that around the world, but they start with not imprisoning so many people and then providing more in the way of rehabilitation and mental health care so that people don't have to spend all their time in solitary confinement.
Well, and I hope that your work, which really brings also the research on this topic to bear on policy decisions, deserves much greater discussion in the policy realm.
We are working on that as we speak.
Well, we've been talking with forensic psychiatrist Dr. Terry Coopers of the Wright Institute and author of the book Prison Madness. Thank you for being our guest. We really appreciate your work and sharing your work with your House listeners.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. Thank you, Adam, for having that conversation with Dr. Coopers. The part about the solitary confinement was profound to me.
Yeah, it suggests that our treatment paradigm, at least as a physician's, and our acquiescence in something in the mental health field, even in prisons, that we have to speak out more. And I appreciate the work that Dr. Coopers is doing to educate folks. So it's wonderful he was able to share some of his research with us and his expertise.
Yeah, he did a great job. Now we're going to have some time for some house calls, and we're going to answer some questions about your health questions, your health concerns, and hopefully provide some insight that's helpful to all of our listeners.
Yeah, and we have some wonderful questions today that are going to be looking at bone spurs and irritable bowel syndrome, weight loss, and hearing aids as it relates to pacemakers. Some really kind of common questions that it's interesting, Christy. These are not things that I would think about, but it's the sort of things people come to us and ask us questions about.
Absolutely. Let's get started.
It's your very first house call.
Hi, I have a question to ask you. My name is Alita, and I have a bone spur on my big right toe. And my understanding is if I had surgery for it, there's a possibility it could grow back. Is that true?
Ooh, thank you, Alita, for that particular question. Christy, what do you think? Do you think she's got a bunion?
Well,
what do you think?
Yeah, you wonder if it truly is a bone spur or a bunion. But people do get bone spurs on their big great toe sometimes. Most people who have bone spurs are in their feet. And it's really related to plantar fasciitis. And so usually nobody recommends that you remove those bone spurs anymore. It's more about treatment of that plantar fasciitis. But on the toe, sometimes a surgical procedure is done. But yeah, you're right. It can grow back. And
well, and a lot of times with a big toe, they talk about bone spurs, but really it's what we call a bunion, or the fancy medical term, hallux valgus deformity, which is really common. And it really is bothersome to a lot of people because, you know, it's tough as that bone gets growing abnormally to fit into your normal shoes. And it can be really painful.
It can. I mean, I recommend to people first to do the first line treatments, to rest it. If your foot is bothering you, use some anti-inflammatory medicine, proper shoes. If there's,
yeah, or even shoe modification, because you may need to have something specially done in the shoes there. See someone who really maybe specializes in orthotics.
Absolutely. Personal orthotics that are made for your foot cost a lot of money, but they could be very, very helpful. So there are more conservative treatments other than surgery that you would want to pursue first. Because depending on whether this is a bone spur or a bunion, sure, it can grow back, especially if you're continuing to do the same sort of activity as you were doing before.
And if you need to have surgery, recognize, at least for a bunion, there are over 150 types of surgical procedures. So do someone who does it a lot and can share with you the kind of data you want to have to make a decision about, are you going to be pain-free and what kind of limitations will you have after such?
Mm-hmm.
What's our very next house call today?
This is Rita, and I have a question for the radio show. My question is about colas, and I'd like to know, is there any disadvantage of a person with IBS taking a colas every day to regulate bowel movements, like 100 milligrams a day?
That is another really good question. I have a lot of patients who take Colace, which is a stool softener. You can get it over the counter. Most people take one pill a day, which
I think
is
its generic name is called
sodium.
Yeah, Ducosate. I'll call it Colace.
Yeah, I know, Colace.
Yeah. And it really just, it kind of binds water into the gut. So for people who have constipation.
Yeah, and my take on this is that if it helps you with your symptoms and helps you function, then it's probably okay to continue taking it as long as you keep up your fluids, because it does pull that water out that you don't want to get dehydrated.
Yeah, and you know, that's interesting, is we typically think of irritable bowel syndrome or IBS as having this kind of fluctuating diarrhea or loose stools, but there is a subset of IBS that it's constipation is the predominant symptom here. And so I did a quick literature search, and I couldn't really find a lot written about this specific treatment, but there is a lot written about this constipation IBS, and you've got to treat the constipation.
Sure. And if this helps you, then I think it's totally fine for you to keep taking it along with lots of fluids.
Yeah. Win-win from Christy and I. Let's listen to what our very next house call is.
For an adult over 60 who is physically fit, eats properly, exercises often, and drinks with moderation, how can this person lose 7 to 8 pounds? It's tough. This is Jamie.
Yes, it is tough. It sounds like you're working really hard and trying to do all the right things. We appreciate you sharing your experience with us.
And you're doing a lot of things right here. You're physically fit. You're eating properly. You exercise often. You drink in moderation. Wow.
Those are all really good things.
We like those things. And yet you want to lose a little bit of weight.
And that's an admirable thing to do, especially if that's important for you and for your health. One suggestion I'd have is to try writing down what you eat, because a lot of times you may be eating well and making good choices, but perhaps it's about portions. Perhaps it's about the types of soft drinks that you drink, if you drink them. And sometimes it's hard to notice those patterns until you actually write it all down. That's why Weight Watchers is so effective.
Yeah, and I've been increasingly, Christy, talking about with patients about knowing not only the amount, but also the types. We talk about the glycemic load or how, you know, is carbohydrate for carbohydrate all the same? So reducing the carbohydrates and also reducing certain types of carbohydrates that have high what's called glycemic indexes. So, for instance, potatoes have very high carbohydrates. They're also a very high glycemic index. So the amount that you get, the per serving, could be 10 or 15 times higher than something like table sugar, which has very high sugar content, but has very low carbohydrates per serving.
So, and I would also suggest that you have a session with a nutritionist, have another session with a trainer, kind of get some tips on how you can make even better choices with the ones you're already making.
Yep. Well, hopefully that's helpful for you. Keep up your good work, and let's go to our very next house call.
My name is Harold, and I'm having a question about a hearing aid I have for listening to the TV. I was told that I have it too close to a pacemaker that I have, that it might be dangerous. The company advises me that they haven't had trouble with this for a long time. Could you advise me about this?
That is an excellent question, and I had to look at this, because I do know that the hearing aids often have these warnings saying that you're not supposed to have it with a pacemaker.
Well, and also,
there have been some studies done on it.
Well, and also, it's unclear here. You know, you're listening to the TV. Is this through one of these transmitters that just amplifies the TV? So these sorts of things don't necessarily rest in fully in your ear. They can be in a transmitter, almost like a headphone. So, you know, I don't know if it matters as much, but there are some warnings by some, even though I think it's pretty safe.
It is pretty safe. The studies we're looking at that. The concern is about the remote control for if you have one of the hearing aids with a remote control, that being too close to your pacemaker. But the studies that were done show that really the function of the pacemaker was not affected by having a hearing aid, but that the remote recordings, if you kept that remote control within an inch of your pacemaker, so in the pocket, like right over your heart pocket, that there were some reduced ability to transmit the signal to your doctor if they're recording it.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think we don't want to recommend that if you're whatever the device is that you're hearing with, that it shouldn't be right on top of your pacemaker. It should be like 4 inches away, which, you know, if it's up about your ears and your chin, it, you know, it probably is. And one other thing, Christy, that was interesting was iPhones, which I didn't realize this, with pacemakers, and that they recommend that an iPhone also be 6 inches from a pacemaker. So, you know, I could see yourself sometimes taking your phone and just as you're laying down, putting it right on your chest. Probably not a good idea with your iPhone to put it right on top of your pacemaker.
Probably not a good idea. Good point, Adam.
Well, hopefully the house calls today, we've had a chance to, talk about these pacemakers and hearing devices.
And Colace for IBS.
And how maybe to lose a little bit of weight, both with Weight Watchers and maybe really being more aware of the glycemic load that you're having.
So we do want you to share your questions with us. Thank you for those who did today. You can write us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Call us at 919-966-8081. You can visit us at yourhealthradio.org.
Or send us right now something on Twitter. Let us know what you're thinking.
We'd like to thank the staff of WCHL and the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Terry Coopers. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of UNC Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And we'll talk to you again next week.
Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.